Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Court of Appeals. Before we get going, I just want to make sure that we can hear everyone and that you all can see us. So, Ms. Lathrop, we can see you. Could you speak so we can hear you?
Good morning, Your Honor.
We hear you. And Mr. Schumacher, could you unmute yourself, please?
There we go. Thank you.
Thank you. And we can hear you if at any time during this argument someone drops off or you can't hear us, just raise your hand to let us know, okay? Otherwise, we'll assume that you're hearing and seeing just fine. And so I'm going to have the marshal call the case.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Flory, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Denise Riley presiding. Now calling the case of Ellis versus City of Minneapolis, A20-0443.
And counsel, I know that you're familiar with how we are organized. Everything is being recorded. So when you start your argument, please state your name for the record. You'll each have 15 minutes. And then Ms. Lathrop, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Are you ready to proceed?
I am ready, Your Honor.
Then you may.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Good morning, counsel. My name is Sarah Lathrop, and I represent the appellant, the City of Minneapolis. The claims against the city in this case should be dismissed because the city's housing inspector's actions are protected by official immunity. The city's entitled to official immunity in this case because the acts of the housing inspector that have been challenged here by the respondents, landlords Harriet and Andrew Ellis, require the exercise of judgment and discretion, and official immunity by case law prevents a government employee from being held liable for performing a duty that calls for that discretion.
So let me ask you this, Ms. Lathrop, because that really gets to the heart of the issue. What mechanism would a citizen landlord then have if the decision of a housing inspector is to issue a correction order is protected by official immunity? What mechanism does a citizen landlord have then to challenge the validity of that decision? Your argument almost seems like, well, the city has carte blanche. They make the decision, it's protected and it's unchallengeable. That seems to raise serious due process questions for me. So can you tell me what remedy the landlord would have to challenge the decision to issue a correction order?
Thank you, Judge Flory. There are limits on it. And so I think that satisfies due process concerns. Number one, even if a duty is discretionary, can I just pause for a second? I assume that the time on the thing has started, and I just wanted to note that so I don't go over. As a matter of law, a duty requires discretion and judgment, reflecting professional standards and goals, that can still be challenged if there is evidence that the decision maker or the government actor is guilty of a malicious or willful wrong, that is doing something that they knew that was wrong. That is not something that is before the court in this particular case. The district court concluded that the challenged duties were discretionary and were ministerial. And so she did not reach the question of malice, but that is a check on that. The second thing that is true in this case and is in the record is that if a landlord has concerns about the standards that are being applied to their property, there's a multitude of avenues for them to raise those challenges with the City of Minneapolis, and the record is replete with them in this case.
But then the City of Minneapolis would claim that there's official immunity, wouldn't they? I mean, seems like that's a circular argument.
Your Honor, I don't think it is a circular argument because there's multitude of avenues for a person to challenge them. And Mr. Ellis, who was the primary person dealing with the incident or the situation in this case, took some of those avenues and didn't take some of those avenues, chose not to take some of the avenues. The record is full of testimony and evidence that The landlord can call the inspector and ask to talk it over with them. He did that in this case. The landlord can ask to have a supervisor come out. Numerous supervisors that were deposed talked about how they would do that. They talked about there's numerous of depending on the violation, there's an administrative process called the Housing Board of Appeals that provides due process protections for this. And I think the fact that there's a court, you know, created doctrine of official immunity does mean that there has been a decision that in order for government conduct to proceed and that government isn't prohibited and bogged down with exercising its duties that it's required to do to enforce public policy. And here, that important public policy is public health, public safety, and public welfare. There is a trade-off, which is that some litigants that may want to exercise their rights to claim that a decision was negligent are not able to do that. And there's, you know, cases, many cases in the case law where the stakes are much, much higher than this, where a person died or multiple people died when a government actor made a decision that the court concluded was protected by discretionary immunity, official immunity, because it called for discretion.
Yeah, and I'm familiar with those cases, the high-speed chases, the running red lights by police officers and things like that. And clearly those are discretionary decisions, but there doesn't seem to be any cases that say that a police officer's decision to issue a traffic citation is protected by discretionary immunity, which seems to be somewhat analogous to what we're dealing with here. Because people challenge, you know, what the validity of traffic citations or other charges regularly, and there's no claim of any official immunity. And, you know, it seems like we have somewhat of an analogous situation here where they're challenging the validity of the correction order, which the district court judge found to be very ministerial as opposed to discretionary. I'm having a hard time making the leap from writing the citation or writing the correction order to somehow turning that into a discretionary act.
Your Honor, I think there's a difference between challenging a, like if it was a criminal case. In fact, I could get into, there actually is a criminal case against Mr. Ellis that's kind of buried in the citations in this case. But there's a difference between a criminal prosecution and a civil lawsuit over housing violations. And I think, but there is a lot of analogous case law about criminal justice acts, such as a police officer assessing whether probable cause exists, police officer assessing whether force is reasonable. So these are all concepts that are, you know, deeply aligned with due process and Fourth Amendment and all kinds of constitutional concepts. And yet the protection under state law is still there to protect those decisions as discretionary. And so I think it's very similar to those cases like in Elwood versus—
No, because, so you have a suppression hearing in a criminal case and the judge, or you have a first hearing and the judge determines whether or not there is probable cause. As I understand your posture in this case, there's no point at which Mr. Ellis can challenge whether or not this citation is valid. And I want to get back to something you said at the beginning. You start out by, I think, saying that we don't want to hold these individual inspector liable. But when I looked at the complaint, the request for relief is that there be a judicial determination regarding the validity of the alleged code violation, there be an injunction against the enforcement of it, and that there be a declaratory relief that they have the right to have that rental dwelling unit reoccupied. So there's nothing that implicates the individual inspector in this case.
Your Honor, the way that the public policy behind official immunity is explained and discussed in the case law is that subjecting housing inspectors, it's not that they're going to be personally liable and have to write a check. It's that by being hauled into court and having to endlessly discuss, and the court talks about, you know, requiring us to second guess discretionary decisions, that is not something that is in alignment with public policy, because that creates harm. It chills government actors from executing and effectuating public policy.
Now, discretionary immunity isn't something that's just granted to government officials. Discretionary immunity depends upon the examination of the specific act, each act that the government official undertakes, correct?
That's correct.
So what I'm concerned with, counsel, is when I look at Mr. Babcool, is that how you pronounce his name?
Babcool, yes.
When I look at his affidavit, he doesn't tell us anything. He doesn't tell us what he did. He just says, there's this violation. I used my discretion and judgment and found a violation. And it's, I can't tell from the record what exactly he did to use his exercise or to use his discretion or judgment in order to arrive at the particular violation. Is that in the record anywhere?
It is, Your Honor. If you look at, I believe it's Lathrop Declaration Exhibit 10 is a series of like hundreds of photographs that show the conditions that were in this apartment. It shows a tremendous amount of unsafe and unsanitary conditions in an apartment with the floor completely peeled up in the bathroom, with water damage throughout, with surfaces, ceiling, floor, window trim.
Yep, I'm familiar with the pictures. But where in that affidavit does it talk about, here's what I did to exercise my discretion to arrive at these particular violations?
Okay, Your Honor, Mr. Babicool talks about in his affidavit, I mean, the duties we're talking about is that he goes into a housing unit, he observes the conditions, and then he compares it to a completely flexible and general standard, which has to be flexible in general in order to apply to just the unbelievably varied conditions that one sees if you go into housing units. And so what he's looking
at- Where's that in this affidavit?
Maybe
in the record?
During the respondent's argument, I'll look for the citation for that. But okay. He does talk about, I certainly think that that's in Mr. Babicool's deposition transcript as well. He talks about how he's comparing what he's seeing to the standards, such as, is this kept in a professional state of repair? Is this done in a reasonably skillful manner? Is this done, is a sink in good and working condition? These are adjectives that are very, very similar in their general application and their general nature as adjectives and standards that the appellate courts in Minnesota have held represent discretionary duties. It's impossible to understand how a housing inspector can apply the phrase reasonably impervious to moisture without exercising their professional judgment and comparing it to the standards in his, in housing.
So Ms. Lathrop, on that point and following up on what Judge Prish asked, I've reviewed the record too, and I agree that the photos in certain areas are significant, but I think I could make a judgment without any training at all that there may be a violation there by looking at those. I'm wondering if you can point me to something in the record that I've missed that shows what type of special training and experience that these inspectors have that they have to rely on in making those discretionary decisions as you describe them. Because I couldn't find anything that said, this is the special training that these people receive, such as special training maybe police officers receive in exercising judgment in a high speed chase that allows them to make those decisions. Because I mean, I can look at a bathroom floor that has a rip in the flooring and say, yeah, that's not impervious to water. I don't think that takes any special training. What in the record shows that there's some sort of special training Mr. Babicle received in order to make those judgments.
I'll find those citations during respondent's argument as well, Your Honor, but I would still say that, if you look at the case, Lewis Lustack versus Carlton County, which is an unpublished decision, but it provides persuasive authority to the court. That was the case that I talked about in my brief that talked about, Minnesota Department of Transportation specifications requiring to remove and replace unsuitable and unstable soils, or, soil moisture content allowing proper compaction. So it's the same type of general adjectives that are being applied. There isn't any discussion in that case, or really any of these cases, where it talks in depth about the background of the professional that's applying it. It is talking about the nature of the act. So when you talk about reasonably impervious to moisture, perhaps someone, like me that isn't a professional could look at that. But the very fact that the standard calls for a reasonable impervious to moisture talks about discretion.
But the question is what did he do to arrive at the violation? Did he just look at it and then he said, there's a hole in the ground, there's going to be a problem here? Or, does the sink work? I turned on the water faucet, the sink didn't work. I mean, is that really an exercise of discretion, or is that just a ministerial act? I turned it on and off, it doesn't work.
I think, Your Honor, that it is not ministerial because it has to
be. Turning the faucet on is not ministerial?
Assessing whether what is in great likelihood a very old building and whether the conditions in front of an inspector are in reasonably good working condition. They're applying discretion on whether a sink. They're trying to be fair to the landlords and keep housing safe for tenants. Okay,
but so there. See, this is kind of where you lose me, because the case law requires that we look at the specific conduct of the government actor, and I don't know what the specific conduct is. Did he just turn the faucet on, or did he do something else to determine whether the sink worked? That's the problem for me.
So I think it's comparable, Judge Frisch, to if you look at the cases that talk about like Elwood versus Rice County, whether probable cause exists. All they're talking, what's described in that case is that what the officers observed with their eyes. They don't talk about, did they sit there and contemplate it? Did they go through their training? And they just, what they observed. That's exactly what this type of case does. And when you talk about
the judicial determination about probable cause.
Pardon me, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
They get a judicial determination about probable cause. What you are asking is that there is no judicial determination, that we just leave it to the city to decide.
Your Honor, in Elwood versus Rice County, that was entering a home without a warrant and under exigent circumstances. So it wasn't about a judicial determination. It's whether a probable cause existed in that moment, and the court said that was a discretionary decision. I see my time is up.
I have one final question, and that's that if we affirm the district court, just procedurally, it goes back for a bench trial, right?
And that's what the court decided.
Bench trial about the however many violations are still out there and whether or not there were violations. Is that right?
I think what the standard is, in this ordinance, it says, was there a reasonable basis to believe that there was a violation? So it isn't strictly either or. Which is another aspect of the discretionary nature of the standard.
So would there be a day or two bench trial?
I'm so sorry, Your Honor. I'm missing the first couple words of every time you speak, but the judge Burke did say that she would hold a bench trial, on the matters that she did not dismiss as being immune.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Schumacher, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am. thank you, judges. And my name is John Schumacher. May it please the court. Counsel, I would like to get right to the issue here that Judge Burke was faced with, And that is where you have a very troublesome factual scenario, and the court is looking at the court's previous decision in Press versus City of Minneapolis. Court looks at that, and it looked at as well the city ordinance 244.80, which is the jurisdictional statute and the requirement that the city enforce its code, or any other person withstanding, and that clearly is my clients, the respondents, Ellis's. And so the action was brought for the injunctive relief, the declaratory relief. However, the complaint does have somewhat of a statement regarding the loss of rent, but there's not a claim in there for negligence. There's no claim there for a monetary action. And the court is correct that there is no, that the inspector was not added as a party. So what we're seeking here, we've been seeking, is a determination that would, in effect, force the city to, and the city inspectors, to either get better training or to be more careful in their issuance of city code orders that have significant police power enforcement behind them. And it's problematic here that the Ellis's could not come in under the Press versus City of Minneapolis and seek a court determination that the inspector's interpretation of the code, his inspection itself, was being done in violation of the city ordinance and in violation of the housing maintenance code. So the relief that we've sought is in fact injunctive and declaratory. And we would ask that the court would affirm Judge Burke's order, and so that this matter can be brought before her for the bench trial to determine, in fact, are there additional code orders above and beyond what the inspector had already admitted, which was about 36% of his orders. He had issued 19 orders, eventually about not quite 3 months later, after oral and written communications from Mr. Ellis, as well as a letter from myself to the inspector, he admitted that 7 of the 19 were in fact unsubstantiated, unsupported, or were flawed. And I think the key thing here that Judge Burke recognized, which is very important for citizens, for property owners, for rental property owners, is that where you have such a high degree of inaccuracies, calling apartment 5 unit 35, calling a furnace or a boiler a furnace, not calling a boiler room, but a rear basement hallway, looking at a tenant complaint, anonymous tenant complaint that says the smoke detectors and CO detectors are not operational, but instead saying they're not there, requiring fire and security doors to be replaced when in fact 3 months later, the inspector says, well, I've checked around and you're already compliant. These types of issues that property owners face with the city of Minneapolis are very troublesome. And I think the procedure is not that cumbersome, because the action can be brought before the district court under 244.80 with the press decision, and the court can make the determination as to whether or not the city is out of bounds, is out of line. And
so Mr. Shoemaker, I just want to make sure, I've been listening to your argument, I want to make sure I understand completely the relief you're requesting. Are you suggesting that the relief that you're going to ask from the district court is something beyond dealing with the specific issues in this case, and that should be applicable to other landlords that aren't involved in it? Because, I mean, to me, that's a troublesome suggestion. I thought the relief you were requesting was limited solely to the alleged violations in this case and asking the court to address those specifically, as opposed to a more broad application to landlords in general.
That's a very good question. And the claims here are limited strictly to the respondent's property and the subject orders here, Your Honor. And so there's no, if the court issues a decision, obviously this will highlight to other citizens the difficulties here that a property owner has experienced, and they can certainly take note of that. But our claims are simply related to this inspector and this property.
Council, you mentioned that you are proceeding under 244-80. Is it your contention that the adoption of 244-80 amounts to a waiver of immunity by the city?
I think it. Yes, 244.80 actually says that as it relates to enforcement of the Housing Maintenance Code, it lists out the Director of Regulatory Services as a party that can enforce it, as well as anyone who has standing, and that would include a property owner. And so the question then becomes enforcement of the code or defense, as the court stated in Press versus City of Minneapolis. If you claim there's an unlawful order, a vague order, something along the lines of what we have alleged here, that then you can go to district court. And of course, many landowners will go and through the administrative hearing process, which is certainly there. And there was a question of Ms. Lathrop as to what are the there's no alternative to go to court, what are the other reliefs? And she was somewhat vague as it relates to what would be the remedies. Talk to the inspector. Well, my client did for almost 3 months. He tried to as well to contact supervisors. He got nowhere. So he filed this action. And so clearly Press versus City of Minneapolis, it's the only case of its kind. But it certainly lays out a roadmap as it relates to 244.80, and it does provide jurisdiction and standing for anyone that's involved. And it may even involve the tenant would have standing in this regard. The district court here made note that there would not be undue prejudice to the city inspector or the city by requiring the city to be more careful with its inspections and its issuance of orders. Here, the orders are in the nature of about 36% that are inaccurate, according to the inspector 3 months later. My clients submit, and we will present evidence at the bench trial, that it was closer to 50%. And so then the question becomes, what is the city policy as relates to inaccurate orders? And the policy, as testified to by two recently retired inspectors, that is recently after the case was filed, Inspector Rumpy and Inspector Allison, is that where there's an inaccurate order, they didn't say you had to have a certain number of inaccuracies, but where there's an inaccurate order, a flawed order, the policy would be to cancel the order, and then to Inspector Allison said to reissue, that is send out a new corrected notice. And the court below noted that that was important as it relates to accurate government records. Inspector Allison also said that's important because if he's not the inspector going back for the reinspection, the new inspector or the replacement inspector is going to have an inaccurate order. And the property owner as well, for due process reasons, needs to know exactly how to comply. So 244.150, that's the notice provision in the Housing Maintenance Code, states that where the inspector finds in an inspection that there's a claim violation, the city's requirement for the inspector is that they issue a written notice that specifies the claim violation and the remedial action required. And so when you specify in a written notice something that's flawed, that's wrong, or is an inaccurate description of a code violation or inaccurate description of a condition, that is not specificity. And so that's why Inspector Allison and Inspector Rumpy said that the city policy was to cancel the order and reissue the order. And that way there's a proper government record. That was not done here. And in fact, there were statements by Inspector Babcool to Mr. Ellis that he would change, for example, the inaccurate statement that there was a furnace in this five-unit building to a boiler. And when his subsequent written notice out to Mr. Ellis came, he hadn't changed it. So now this was a new inspector. The record will reflect that he started sometime in early to mid 2017, and he had a couple of orders to Mr. Ellis during the summer of 17. The evidence there was that Mr. Ellis timely complied. Then there was this tenant complaint. After Mr. Ellis had difficulty with the tenant and was seeking to evict the tenant for non-payment of rent, had made notice, delivered notice to the inspector that the tenant was not letting the landlord into the property, and that when the landlord got into the property was trashed. Now those—
this is all very factual specific, which really isn't something that we need to determine at this point, because we're looking de novo at a summary judgment grant here. And we're also looking, I think we also have de novo review as to whether, or not, as to the issue in the case, and that is whether or not official immunity protects the act. So, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I don't know that a long factual discussion about the disputed facts is helpful, because none of those have been determined by a court yet. You know, we're really looking de novo at whether or not the court erred in its decision on the application or lack of application of official immunity. And I think that's where we need to concentrate our argument.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'll do that. I think that Judge Burke certainly noted that the specifics of this inspector's conduct were straightforward, that the code required certain mandated conduct, and that is to, for the inspector to look at the code provision and to then make an observation within the unit and then determine whether or not there's reasonable basis to claim there was a violation. That's one part. Number two, then when the inspector completed the inspection, he was to go back and to issue a written notice. The judge below said that that was important to be accurate, and that when his notice that was issued out to Mr. Ellis was not inaccurate, that ministerial act, there was a violation of the code. And then when he did, the judge now below did not go to the issue of should there be a reissuance of the corrected notice to the property owner. That has been claimed in the complaint, in the opposition memorandum, in opposition to summary judgment. It's even in the city's brief. It acknowledges that request was made. That will be a request to the district court that the city reissue these notices and make a public record of the inaccuracies, so that when the public goes to the property lookup page that the city has, that the city city public there will be able to see that there was only that 7 out of the 19 claims were inaccurate.
So, Mr. Baker, this is Judge Riley.
Yes.
You did not file a cross appeal on Judge Burke's decision that the do not occupy orders are discretionary acts.
That's correct.
And in one of your requests for relief, you're seeking lost rents.
I believe that's in the complaint. As I mentioned earlier, that's not our claim, and we haven't amended the complaint, but we have no claim for negligence or any other basis for that. It was purely Chapter 555 and the 244.80.
Okay, thank you.
We would request, Your Honors, that the court here affirm the summary judgment and that the court remand the case for the bench trial, and thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Lathrop, any rebuttal?
Sorry, I've got to get to my screen. Oh boy, it's not working. There we go. Okay, sorry about that. Yes, it may please the court. I wanted to respond to a few of the questions that the court had posed during my initial argument. I wanted to respond to Judge Flory's questions first. He had talked about what special training could be required for the decisions being made here, and how is that different than just anybody like me who doesn't know about housing inspection standards. So I flipped through the photographs that the color photographs are Exhibit 10 to my declaration that was submitted in summary judgment. And I think in there you see a variety of conditions that to my eye seem out of standard with what I would want my house to look like, or that I would want a loved one to stay in so that they had safe and secure housing for their rent and sanitary housing. But the standard that the inspectors are being asked to apply is whether that's kept in a professional state of repair. So that's a different standard than, does this look okay to a layperson? To apply a professional state of repair, they have to know what is the standard in the industry for professional state of repair. And that's very different than what may seem okay to me, especially when you're talking about very old housing units that have been repaired and replaced many, many times. One example of that as well is in the deposition of Andrew Ellis, who is one of the plaintiff respondents in this case. He talked about how he objected to one of the orders relating to leaking water. And he said, there's no leaking water. There's just a stain. And that doesn't count as a violation of the housing code. So that's something specialized. He happened to be a Minneapolis housing inspector for 27 years. He's saying in his experience and his professional knowledge that there's a difference between staining and a leak. Okay, so that's something that I wouldn't know.
But what was the specific act of the inspector in determining that any of these violations deviated from a professional standard of repair? Where's that in the record?
Yes, Judge Frisch, I was gonna respond to that next. So I again flipped through the deposition of Frederick Babicool and the definition or the deposition of Tang Vang, who's another housing inspector for the city. Okay, so Fred Babicool talked about how he observed, he toured, he took photographs, he examined them, and then he went back to his office and he compared what he observed in the photographs he took with the standards that's in the housing maintenance code. He talked to his colleagues and his supervisor in the office and he discussed it. He also, and this is something that the respondents complain about, conducted numerous conversations with Mr. Ellis about whether the standards that he was applying were fair. And so he's talking it out with Mr. Ellis. He's listening to Mr. Ellis and comparing what Mr. Ellis is saying to the standards. And in some cases he's like, you know what? I can see that. In fact, there was one he talked about with a door and he said, I didn't realize that my colleagues had previously said that these doors are okay. So I'm gonna cancel that one. So he's going through and he's comparing his observations to the standards in the code and the professional experiences that he has had and that his colleagues has had. So that is the type of discretion that shows that he's exercising discretion and applying his professional judgment to the standards in the industry, which is exactly the type of action that's protected by official immunity. The other thing that I wanted to say, I'm forgetting which of your honors asked this question, but Mr. Babicool repeatedly mentions his training. He's asked about in your training, in your experience in his deposition. And Tang Vang also talks about the training he's received in order to issue housing codes violations. And so I think that that's goes to the question of, you know, is this just anybody off the street could find this? You know, the district court said there is or there isn't a housing code violation. And I think if you look at the photographs, it's clear that there's some pretty varied and, you know, complicated setups in housing stock in Minneapolis. And someone has to have the knowledge in order to apply whether does this meet the standard of professional state of repair, for instance, or safe and unobstructed means of egress. I see my time is up, so I would just ask that the court reverse the judgment below and grant the city official immunity. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. The case is submitted and we'll have our decision out within the 90 days.
Thank you very much.